Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. With less than 2 weeks before the first presidential debate on September the 26th, moderated by Lester Holt of NBC News, we'll examine whether it will follow the example of the recent candidates forum, where the moderator Matt Lauer wasted Hillary Clinton's time rehashing her use of a private email server, then was steamrolled by Donald Trump, whose ridiculous assertions about national security and the state of the military were left unchallenged. James Fellows, an award-winning author and national correspondent for The Atlantic, joins us to discuss his latest article in The Atlantic, When Donald Meets Hillary, and what might happen in a debate between someone who can give in-depth answers on a wide range of issues and someone who knows very little beyond slogans and does not answer questions, but is skilled at personal attacks and delivering insults. Then we'll speak with Travis Ridout, who is a distinguished professor of government and public policy in the School of Politics, Philosophy, and Public Affairs at Washington State University. He's the co-director of the Wesleyan Media Project, which tracks political advertising, and we will discuss how much Donald Trump has broken the mold of traditional campaigning with his ability to attract free media while spending a fraction of what Hillary Clinton is paying for political advertising. With Trump having managed to pull even with Clinton in some polls, we will look into how Bernie Sanders voters are abandoning Clinton for the libertarian Gary Johnson, which, as the race tightens, could enable a Trump victory. Then finally, we are joined in the studio by Victoria Sanford, a cultural anthropologist who has spent years uncovering evidence of genocide in Guatemala, and Dr. Marvin Perez, who was 14 when he was disappeared by the Guatemalan military and tortured along with 15 other kids, three of whom were never seen again. They will discuss the International Conference on the Guatemalan Genocide organized by the USC Shoah Foundation, which is underway, that Victoria Sanford organized along with Wolf Gruner, the founding director of USC's Center for Advanced Genocide Research. And joining us now is James Fellows, who's an award-winning author and national correspondent for The Atlantic. He previously worked as President Carter's chief speechwriter and was editor of U.S. News and World Report. His books on media and politics include Who Runs Congress, Breaking the News, How the Media Undermines American Democracy, Blind into Baghdad, America's War in Iraq, and his latest, China Airborne, The Test of China's Future. He has an article at The Atlantic, When Donald Meets Hillary. Welcome to Background Briefing, James Fellows.
Ian, it's nice to talk to you once again.
And thank you, James. And I don't imagine that when Donald meets Hillary, it's going to be quite like when Harry met Sally in the movie. Yeah, certainly won't have the orgasm scene, I don't imagine.
Oh, God save us.
But at this moment, Hillary Clinton is recuperating from walking pneumonia. We don't know how many days she's going to be out of pocket, do we?
We don't know for sure whether Donald Trump will actually show up for debates, although he says he will. And so everything about this debate cycle is conditional. But assuming they go ahead, assuming that Hillary Clinton is back in shape, as I think she will be, assuming that Donald Trump shows up, it could well be the most watched event in television history, just because, number one, debates usually are, and number two, this is such an extraordinary contrast and matchup.
Well, for that reason, though, surely Donald Trump will show. He's a man never to shun the spotlight.
You are saying certainly and never when it comes to Donald Trump. You are a brave man.
Okay. Well, it does seem, though, that there's a certain asymmetry here. This is obviously the year of the outsider. Status quo politicians are struggling all across the board. And it seems to me that the real asymmetry is that Donald Trump is a sort of creature of reality television, and he's in his own movie, which is Survivor in the White House, and he's making the rules up as he goes along. He's knocked everybody off the island in the first reality show, which was the Republican primaries, and it doesn't seem like anybody's able to handle him, least of all the press.
Well, that's certainly, I agree with you about the press. And when it comes to the reality show nature with which he's gotten this far, I agree with that, too. And I think it's important to recognize how much the rules, to the extent rules apply to anything these days, change when it comes to a general election contrast and a general election debate. In the primary debates, when it was Trump against six other people, 10 other people, whatever, all that matters was that he got a little more airtime than the rest of them and had his little zingers. And in a two-person debate, he'll have to to actually fill airtime with details of what he thinks about NATO or what he thinks about taxes or whatever. And I think it is it plays less well to his quite formidable reality TV skills.
But if the National Security Town Hall that took place a few days ago that Matt Lauer moderated, first with Hillary Clinton, followed by Donald Trump, if that's a precursor or a predicate, then it would seem that Hillary Clinton's advantages of being a policy wonk and being able to give detailed answers, I mean, I'm not sure that Lester Holt is going to nitpick over the well-trod ground of Clinton's email server and not ask national security questions, which was what happened with Lauer. And then, of course, Trump steamrolled him and never answered a question. So do you think that that's put these other moderators on notice, do you think?
I think it has. And in a way, you could think of that Matt Lauer episode serving sort of the purpose of the Brexit vote, where because Brexit turned out as it did, I think the U.S. electorate, its mind was focused, you know, Trump could actually win. And so, too, I think that Lauer's abominable performance may have put these other moderators on guard, both with what Trump might do and also what it would mean for them if they have the same doormat role.
So in the broad sense, though, James Fellows, how do you explain why it is that Hillary Clinton's not 20 or 30 points ahead and, in fact, at this point is pretty even with Donald Trump? Is there a new constituency that hasn't been identified before? Or is this what I've been hearing from Hillary Clinton's internal polling, that the Bernie Sanders voters are all migrating to Gary Johnson, the Libertarian?
On the what's happening to the Bernie voters, I just don't know. I do remember that 8 years ago when Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama had their very, very intense primary battle, it seemed even through the convention that nerves were more frayed between the two of them than they were between the current Sanders people and Hillary Clinton people. Also, it's possible that as the prospect of Trump becomes more real, that could focus attention for the Bernie voters. I think that it's Hillary Clinton as a candidate has both some intrinsic limits. She's not the natural, gifted emoter that her husband is, or the naturally gifted elocutionist that Barack Obama is. And so she just has a handicap. And also there is this decades-long industry of opposition against her. So you would think that Donald Trump, who by my lights is uniquely unqualified to be president, would be further behind. We will see what the next 8 weeks from today bring.
And again, I'm speaking with James Fellows, who's an award-winning author and national correspondent for The Atlantic. He previously worked as President Carter's chief speechwriter and was editor of U.S. News and World Report. And his books on media and politics include Who Runs Congress, Breaking the News, How the Media Undermines American Democracy, Blind into Baghdad, America's War in Iraq, and his latest, China Airborne, The Test of China's Future. And he has an article at The Atlantic, When Donald Meets Hillary. But could it also be that, in effect, there's been a tectonic shift in sort of the culture of politics, if you will? It seems like Donald Trump has created a whole new narrative. It used to be on the McNeil Lair News Hour that the politicians would, in this sort of phony politesse, would say, I respectfully disagree with my learned colleague. And nowadays it's, you're a scumbag, you know. So that's what we've descended into. And that obviously gives Trump an advantage. But also I get the feeling that we're also living in a Kardashian culture where all of the things that Trump is skilled at, Twittering and Facebooking and all of that stuff, has created its own, it's not even a subculture, it may even be, you know, as much of a culture as the traditional political culture that we're used to.
Well, it certainly is the case. We are living through an episode that I think people will mull over for the next 100 years, the next 50 years at least, of trying to understand how this could have happened. I think a lot of things had to align. You had to have Trump's unique reality show skills, also at a time when the reality show mode was dominant. You had to have his being entirely unfazed by saying things that just aren't true, but just, you know, most people, it would bother them. It doesn't bother him at all. You would have to also have the fracture within the Republican Party that's going on now. You'd have to have the miscalculation by all the other Republicans who all assumed he would collapse of his own weight, so they didn't bother to attack him. So 20 different things all had to align to bring Donald Trump to this position, and they all did.
Well, on top of that, you've got the stars aligned against Hillary Clinton. There's nothing worse than coming down with an illness when surrogates of Trump's, like former Mayor Giuliani of New York, has been out sort of spreading conspiracy theories that she's physically unfit for the job.
Yes. And I think that if this goes on for more than a day or two, it'll be an issue. I think if 3 days from now she's out giving speeches in full voice, it will not seem to be that way. But you're right, this was one of many unfortunate things for her. And I think that this will, a week from now, we'll know if this is going to be a, quote, a real thing, unquote.
Well, from what I understand about walking pneumonia, first of all, it's serious. The Muppets inventor, Jim Henson, died from it. And two, it's highly infectious. You certainly, for a politician, you don't kiss babies, right, when you have walking pneumonia. So what is then the strategy, if one could advise Hillary Clinton, and I'm not sure what kind of advice she's getting, but somebody ought to be fired in that campaign after what she came out of the most successful Democratic convention in recent memory. And then it's just her numbers have just consistently eroded. I don't know whether she's living in a bubble or what's going on there, but what advice, obviously, it may well be futile. But since you were Jimmy Carter's chief speechwriter, you've been around politics a lot, what advice would you offer her to turn this thing around?
So I would be presumptuous to be anybody's political strategist, but I guess it's worth noting that so far, there's been in no plausible poll has she been behind so far. You know, and if you look at the electoral college math, she still has an advantage, although obviously it has been eroding. So I would guess their strategy is to find ways to unleash President Obama more, as he was doing today, and he's very, very effective, and probably to move past the stage of trying to change people's minds to actually getting them out to vote. Because we may be at the stage where there's not really anything people need to know more about either Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump to have a sense of what these people would be like as president. So from this stage of the campaign onward, it really is about making sure your people turn out. And that's what Hillary Clinton has a machine in place for. Donald Trump is less experienced at, but the battle commences for real.
And if, as apparently is the case, Hillary Clinton has the ground game because she spent a lot of money on it and Donald Trump doesn't have it because he hasn't, and he's gotten by with a lot of free media. He's not spending anything like she has with commercials. But at the end of the day, there is this thing called the enthusiasm gap. So does that play against what you're just saying?
I think it plays with it. You have to find out what the various enthusiasms are. Certainly there is, compared, say, with Barack Obama at his prime, there is less positive enthusiasm for Hillary Clinton, I would imagine. But I think there is more negative enthusiasm against Donald Trump than there was against either Mitt Romney or John McCain. So all these different vectors push together. You would have to say that again, on math, on probability, on history, Hillary Clinton has an easier road ahead than Donald Trump does, but because nothing is certain, the next 56 days, every single one of them matters.
But liberal Democrats, and the further you go to the left in this country, the less pragmatic and the more idealistic the voter tends to be. They'd rather be righteous than effective. And if it's true that Bernie's voters are migrating to Gary Johnson, who's a libertarian, who presumably the liberals don't realize that all of the government programs they believe in are the ones that Gary Johnson wants to get rid of.
Yeah.
But at the same time, you know, he's against foreign wars and in favor of legalizing marijuana. So do you think that that's, in other words, absent Bernie Sanders stepping up to the plate and, you know, telling his voters who they should vote for, if that indeed is going to happen. Short of that, what do you think can be done?
So I think that there are several factors at play there. One is that so far, Gary Johnson's share of the vote has been much less than Ross Perot's was back in 1992, less strategically important than Ralph Nader's appeared to be in 2000, et cetera. So far it seems to be not that consequential, but of course we'll see. Second, I think this will be a historical test for Bernie Sanders because he has said at several points at the convention when he conceded to Hillary Clinton that it matters fundamentally to him that Donald Trump not become president. So we'll see if he is motivated to make that case to his people. And finally, I guess what you have to say is that if there are people who are, in my view, short-sighted enough to think that Donald Trump, who stands for the antithesis of liberal values, capital L, small L, everything else, that they'd rather let him become president, there is no guarantee against self-destruction for democracies. In my view, that would be self-destruction, but it's one of the possibilities.
Well, just in closing then, James Fellows, if the polls, they're clearly tightening, and as you pointed out, Donald Trump's certainly not ahead. He's even maybe in one or two. But he does seem to be on an upward trajectory, and she seems to be on a downward trajectory, at least since the huge bounce from the Democratic Convention. Is this to say, then, that the down ticket advantage that many pundits have talked about, that Hillary Clinton could swing the Senate for the Democrats, is that in jeopardy?
I think everything is unknown and unknowable. There are a lot of indications that certain states that had seemed contested, like both Virginia and Colorado, are now much more safely Democratic. But there are other indications the other way. And I think that it is it's realistic to say we just don't know how these things are going to play out. And that's why full participation by all citizens and all responsible members of the media, like you and me, is so important over the next 55 plus days.
And what about the irresponsible members of the media who've made Donald Trump, basically given him all this free media and haven't challenged him? And frankly, if he wins, I'm going to blame the media.
Yes, I think that I'm going to blame, number one, him. Number two, a lot of the Republican Vichy establishment, like Paul Ryan and Lorest, but very, very prominently tied for second will be the press. I agree with that. So we can, when I move to my new home in either China or Australia, we can do a show on November 9th explaining how it happened.
Okay. Well, thank you so much. I'm not meaning to inject too much levity in this serious situation, but I thank you for joining us, James Fellows.
My pleasure, Ian. Thank you.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with James Fellows, who's an award-winning author and national correspondent for The Atlantic. He previously worked as President Carter's chief speechwriter and was editor of U.S. News and World Report. His books on media and politics include Who Runs Congress, Breaking the News, How the Media Undermines American Democracy, Blind into Baghdad, America's War in Iraq, and his latest, China Airborne, The Test of China's Future. And he has an article at The Atlantic, When Donald Meets Hillary. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back discussing how much Donald Trump has broken the mold of traditional campaigning. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Travis Ridout, who is a distinguished professor of government and public policy in the School of Politics, Philosophy, and Public Affairs at Washington State University, and the co-director of the Wesleyan Media Project, which tracks political advertising. He conducts research on political campaigns, political advertising, presidential nominations, and campaign finance. Welcome to Background Briefing, Travis Ridout.
Thank you so much.
And Obviously, I want to talk to you about the advertising race between the two presidential candidates, where Hillary Clinton is outspending Donald Trump by a massive factor. But yet, a lot of polls have Donald Trump, even some are even ahead. He seems to be on the rise. Hillary Clinton seems to be on the wane. So what explains this?
Well, I think part of the reason she is hasn't been doing as well as she was is that some of that convention bounce that she received has dissipated. I think also part of it is she's just had a couple of bad weeks in the news media where a lot of negative stories have been focused on her. And so people who might have been convinced after the conventions to vote for Hillary Clinton, you know, I'm not saying they're voting for Donald Trump now, but they may be taking more of a wait-and-see approach or toying with the Libertarian or Green Party candidate.
Well, apparently that's a factor that a lot of the Bernie Sanders supporters who were sort of reluctantly going to support Hillary Clinton after the convention, they're starting to migrate to the Libertarian candidate, Gary Johnson, in spite of his gaffe over not knowing what Aleppo is. So is that a detectable factor?
Well, I think it is. And I think part of the reason for that is for a while we thought Hillary Clinton had the race safely in hand, and which gave some people on the left the freedom to check out another candidate. Gary Johnson, you know, he's a guy most people don't know about, a blank slate, and that can kind of be a good thing or a more attractive thing than two candidates that you really don't like all that much.
But what explains then, you mentioned the press has been a big factor in negative stories, what explains why Donald Trump gets a free pass with the media and Hillary Clinton gets nitpicked to death over what appears to be relatively trivial matters compared, for example, the other day Donald Trump said that if the Iranians come up close to one of our beautiful warships in the Gulf and make rude gestures, we're going to blow them out of the water. If he were president, that would be an act of war. We'd be at war with Iran. No coverage of it, no questioning of him. But meanwhile, endless reportage on Hillary Clinton's talking about a basket full of deplorables.
Right. You know, I think part of it is just that we've heard the statements, the outrageous things that Donald Trump has said before. We've been hearing stories about that. Those things for months and months and months, and in some ways it's becoming an old story. But if Hillary Clinton makes a gaffe or there's a new FBI report or whatever, you know, that's at least a new story, something novel for journalists to focus on. And I think there is, you know, part of them is saying, you know, in order to be fair, we have to cover this as well. And so that act of trying to be fair can often result in negative coverage for Hillary Clinton that other observers might say is not proportionate to what they're giving to Donald Trump.
So let's focus in then on Donald Trump, how he's breaking the mold in all of the research that you conduct, political campaigns, political advertising, and campaign finance. He essentially has been running as a kind of reality TV star who's, you know, knocked all the other contestants off the island in ways that they weren't prepared for. He created a whole new narrative that sort of broke the mold of polite political discourse. But he didn't spend much money. He still hasn't spent a lot of money. He's done very little at television advertising. He got billions of dollars worth of free media. And even now, he's not spending very much on advertising. And he's not spending much on the ground game in terms of having people on the ground in the various states, in particular the swing states. So is he going to, if he's elected president of the United States, is he breaking the mold on business as usual with campaigns?
Well, he's definitely breaking the mold. Other candidates, other Republicans by this point would have had, you know, dozens of field offices open in all of the swing states. They would have been on the air with hundreds of millions of dollars of political advertising in those swing states, and he is trying something new. And, you know, we'll see if it's successful. I have some doubts about whether it will be successful, but I think it's, You know, it is a year in which the electorate seems to be angry. The electorate seems to be upset. He's definitely the outsider candidate, the candidate who's breaking the mold, and that's apparently appealing to a lot of people, whereas Hillary Clinton represents, you know, the past continuity, and it's not necessarily, you know, the ideal political climate for that type of candidate.
Is there any other way to explain the fact that Donald Trump is level, if not ahead, in some of the polls, and he's certainly gaining and she's losing, and it's very hard to get your head around, particularly with the precipitous loss of momentum that Hillary Clinton had from the bounce from the convention, which was certainly, by all accounts, one of the best Democratic conventions in recent memory, and yet here she is, you know, holed up in bed with walking pneumonia, feeding into the Republican narrative that somehow she's not physically fit for the job. So it seems like the universe is conspiring against her. Do you have any other further explanations from the ones that you've given us?
Well, I think part of it is that Trump has been able to run an issueless campaign. Not entirely. There are a couple of issues. We know he wants to build a wall. But other than that, you know, what is his position on a woman's right to choose? I'm not sure, or it varies from day to day. What is his position on, you know, Social Security reform or health care? I'm not really sure. He's not talking about those things. And so, you know, I suspect a majority of Americans would prefer Hillary Clinton's policies on those issues, but, you know, Trump is certainly not talking about policy, and the news media don't seem to be talking all that much about policy either, because they're focused on the circus, they're focused on the latest tweet, and so it's really an election about personality. And for all its faults, the Trump campaign has had some success, aided by the media, in, you know, making this race about Hillary Clinton's personality, and she's been trying to make it about his personality and his character. And so in that regard, maybe it's not so surprising in a race of between two people that we don't like very much, or at least the average American doesn't like all that much, that it is this close.
But is it possible that there are two universals at play here, the traditional political universe where Hillary Clinton, by all accounts, would be a front runner with her experience, which is fairly unique, and her deep resume, somewhat reminiscent of George H.W. Bush. But now we seem to be in a different universe. As I mentioned, that he's sort of a reality TV star. He's broken the mold. It's almost like Survivor in the White House. The person who grabs the most attention, you know, eats the most worms, or no matter, you know, in other words, reality TV is all about the shock value. And he's certainly been able to capture the attention of people with that. And I'm just wondering about whether social media and the changes and the effect that social media has had on our culture is determining this new constituency that seems to be emerging in support of Donald Trump. In other words, you know, status quo politicians are just roadkill in this new era of a kind of Kardashian culture.
Well, I think that's partially correct. In the past, the news media could serve as the gatekeepers. You know, they would decide what the story was about, and they wanted the campaign to, you know, tell them what they thought about a particular issue, whereas now it really seems to be that the campaigns are leading, and they're leading through Twitter, through social media, and the media are having to respond to that. So in that respect, I think things have changed quite a bit.
So what can a conventional politician like Hillary Clinton do to turn this thing around if the trajectory that we appear to be on is the one that's going to lead up to the November election of Donald Trump?
Well, one thing we do know from the past is that people pay attention to the debates. It's an opportunity, it will be an opportunity for her to make her case, to talk about the issues that some people care about, at least, and I'm convinced some people do still care about issues. It'll give her an opportunity to draw those contrasts with Donald Trump, and we'll see how he performs. And there will be a lot of media attention on those debates, and you know, she may look presidential, he may not. That could seal the deal for her.
Well, it does seem that so far it's been a very unconventional political year, wouldn't you say?
I would agree with that 100%.
And that, does that mean that we are in for more surprises? I mean, it's not even October yet, and October, of course, is always associated with the October surprise.
Right. There certainly could be more surprises. It seems like we've had our share of surprises already. But, you know, if political science is right about the way campaigns operate, then voters are going to be paying much more attention in the month of October, and they're going to get around to finally making a decision. We have a lot more undecided voters this year than we had 4 years ago. A lot of people who are toying with their options. I think that last month is going to really make a difference. I think the presence of those field offices and the get-out-the-vote operations in those swing states is really going to make a difference. I don't, in spite of social media, I still think those things matter.
But are we missing a whole new constituency that normally doesn't vote? I mean, there's been a pervasive theory that we have the most shamefully low turnout of all of the major democracies. You know, it's a big election year would be 60%. And I think Jack Kennedy was like 63% or something. So rarely do you get, you know, up to even 60% of the registered voters turning out. And you've got all these other people that aren't registered as well. So it's a massive unknown quantity out there. Is the Trump phenomenon reflective of this notion that a lot of people are coming out of the woodwork who haven't voted before? Or is this just the right wing of the Republican Party who have always been the activist wing? Are they just turning up every last man, woman, and child?
I think it's more the latter. You know, it's hard to believe that there's a large group of people out there who will be inspired by Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton, two candidates who, again, aren't all that well-liked, if you believe the public opinion polls, and inspired enough to get out and vote when they haven't voted for the past decade. And so while we may be seeing them in opinion polls, I'm not sure we're going to see them on election day. It's hard for me to believe that turnout would be higher in 2016 with, again, some fairly uninspiring candidates than it was in, say, 2008.
Well, but nevertheless, there is a detectable enthusiasm gap. It's clear from Donald Trump's rallies that his followers are really fired up. And you don't get sense that from Hillary Clinton. And the fact that that my understanding is that her internal polls indicate a great deal of alarm that Bernie Sanders voters, who she thought she had after the convention, moving across to vote for the Libertarian Gary Johnson. And unless Bernie Sanders steps up to the plate and urges his followers to return to the Clinton fold, she's going to lose. I mean, that seems to be the situation at the moment.
Well, it is a big concern. You know, they do have a pretty good arsenal of surrogates that they can employ. They will be employing President Obama, Bill Clinton, Elizabeth Warren, perhaps Bernie Sanders again, some people that might help to create some enthusiasm for Hillary Clinton's presidency. But that's a big if, and whether they're capable of doing so or not.
Well, Travis Ridout, I hope we can stay in touch, because at least we can agree that this is a wild ride we're on here.
Indeed.
And again, Travis Ridout is a distinguished professor of government and public policy at the School of Politics, Philosophy, and Public Affairs at Washington State University and the co-director of the Wesleyan Media Project, which tracks political advertising. He conducts research on political campaigns, political advertising, presidential nominations, and campaign finance. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back joined in the studio by a cultural anthropologist who has spent years uncovering evidence of genocide in Guatemala and Dr. Marvin Perez, who was 14 when he was disappeared by the Guatemalan military. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now in the studio is Victoria Sanford, who's a cultural anthropologist who studies human rights, international humanitarian law, the anthropology of genocide, race, and gender in the Americas, and child soldiers within Guatemala and Colombia. She is the director of the Center for Human Rights and Peace Studies based at Lehman College, City University of New York, and has spent years uncovering evidence of genocide in Guatemala. And also joining me in the studio is Marvin Perez, who is a torture survivor from Guatemala, who was 14 when he was disappeared by the Guatemalan military and tortured. And he was of the 16 children taken with him, three were never seen again. And today, Marvin is a doctor trained in Western and Chinese medicine. And both of you, of course, are here in Los Angeles for the USC Shoah Foundation Center for Advanced Genocide Research Forum, co-sponsored by the USC Latino Alumni Association and the USC School of International Relations. Victoria, you are a co-organizer of this conference, and welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So let me start with you, Victoria, since you've organized this. Obviously, I'm anxious to talk to Marvin about his extraordinary personal story, but what are you hoping to achieve in this with this three-day conference at USC?
Well, we have a number of different goals with the conference. First, this is the first time that there's been an international conference that brings together scholars from all over the world who study Guatemala. We have scholars from Spain, from Scotland, from England, from Canada, the United States, Mexico, and Guatemala. We have senior scholars like Marta Casaus from Spain, Ricardo Falla, who's a priest who was one of the first people on the front lines reporting the massacres as they happened in Guatemala. And then we have junior scholars who are just beginning their careers or completing their doctorates. One young woman from the University of Michoacán, who herself is the daughter of Guatemalan refugees. So it's also an intergenerational conference, but it's to bring together information about the genocide. And because the Shoah Foundation is sponsoring it, it also really establishes the Guatemalan genocide as a genocide that happens. And interesting aside in it, when I began to work on this with Wolf Gruner, who's the director of the Center for Advanced Genocide Studies at the Shoah Foundation, we wrote a grant proposal seeking assistance for the conference. And one of the responses on from the funder, who we will leave unnamed, was there was no genocide in Guatemala. And so that's the point of this conference, so that people understand, indeed, there was a genocide in Guatemala. And the Shoah Foundation is also beginning a really important archive of testimonies from survivors of the Guatemalan genocide. So just as, and they're just putting up now the beginning of their educational project on the Guatemalan genocide. Just as they have information about the Holocaust and they have information on the Armenian genocide, the Guatemalan genocide will now become part of that archive. And I think it's particularly important because there are so many Guatemalans who live in the Los Angeles area and in the United States. And to have this involvement with the Shoah Foundation is extraordinarily important.
Well, just to deal with the broad facts here, there were over 200,000, mostly Mayan Guatemalans, were killed and more than 1.5 million were displaced during the 1980s. And this genocide was hidden under the cover of a 36-year civil war that ended in 1996 with a peace accord. And now you have a comedian running Guatemala. I mean, it feels a bit like the curse of Donald Trump, you know, Brexit, Guatemala's election. So, Marvin, how do you feel about what's happening in your country today, even though clearly what you experienced when you were a child is obviously a hideous and painful memory, but there has to be at least something to be thankful for, right?
Well, I'm happy to be alive. I'm happy to have a decent life right now. Have a family, have a son. And also something that is very important for me is to keep the memory alive, right? All the events that happened to me back in 1982 when I was 14 years old, was a child. And it's been 34 years since those events. And of those 32 years, I've been looking for justice. And I've been actively speaking about that incident and looking for justice. I have tried different ways to look for justice. 4 years ago, in 2012, my case was presented in Guatemala. It was filed, my case against the Guatemalan government for the crimes that committed back in 1982. And this year, the case was presented to the Inter-American Commission of Human Rights.
Mm-hmm. But just to try and understand, I've often tried to figure out what happened in Argentina, where you had a nominally sort of civilized society, and yet the military turned on its own citizens and conducted the most hideous atrocities. At the age of 14, you were rounded up with 16 children, three of whom never saw the light of day again. What was their justification? Did they ever, your torturers ever indicate to you why they felt it was necessary to torture 14-year-old kids, and for what purpose?
Well, the state of Guatemala and the army, they saw enemies in every person who didn't agree with what they were doing, or any person who was challenging the system or questioning the system or asking for basic things. Sometimes it wasn't just asking major things. It's like for the students at that age, well, could you ask? Okay, for us, it was about better education or better schools or infrastructure and basic kind of things. And for that, at that moment, it was dangerous to ask those kind of things. And for a worker to ask for better working conditions, for asking for a better salary, that was enough to be killed. Mm-hmm. And to be a peasant, to ask for land, that was enough to be killed and to be accused of communist.
I see. Mm-hmm. Well, of course, this all happened under General Rios Montt, who was the favorite of the Reagan White House. In fact, President Reagan did praise him. He belonged to a fundamentalist church here in Northern California.
Correct.
And so in many ways, you know, the right-wing evangelicalism here in the United States is often a sort of front for right-wing politics. And there was that unholy connection with the Reagan White House and these murderous generals. In terms of justice for them and Rios Montt, where do we stand? Because he's been on trial, but he still hasn't been held to account, has he?
Well, he was held accountable for the genocide that happened against the Mayan Ixchiles.
Right.
Unfortunately, the sentence was
overturned
right a few days later.
Right.
He's supposed to face trial again, hopefully soon. We don't know when that's going to happen. But from the perspective of the survivors and the victims of the genocide, they're still willing to go back and go back and share their testimonies, and the experts to go back to the tribunals and share their the evidence that there was genocide against the Mayan population. And Also, crimes that were committing outside the Mayan population, because in Guatemala, the army not only committing crimes in the rural areas, it also committed crimes in the city. It killed Mayans, non-Mayans, it killed women, men, children, elderly. They killed whoever they wanted to kill.
And again, I'm speaking with Victoria Sanford, who studies human rights, international humanitarian law, the anthropology of genocide, race and gender in the Americas, and child soldiers within Guatemala and Colombia. She's the director of the Center for Human Rights and Peace Studies based at Lehman College, City University, New York, and has spent years uncovering evidence of genocide in Guatemala. And also in the studio with us is Marvin Perez, who's a torture survivor from Guatemala, who was 14 when he was disappeared along with 16 other Guatemalan children by the Guatemala military. Three were never seen again. And today, Marvin is a doctor trained in Western and Chinese medicine. And Marvin spoke at the USC Genocide Conference being organized by the USC Shoah Foundation Center for Advanced Genocide Research. And she's Victoria's a co-organizer of the conference. Marvin spoke yesterday. What kind of You mentioned that there's a Guatemalan diaspora here in Los Angeles. How big is it, and what percentage are people that literally fled from the horrors that Marvin endured?
Well, I mean, I think the numbers are really important. So I want to go back for a moment when you had mentioned in the beginning that there were 200,000 people who were killed. There were 626 massacres committed by the army in indigenous villages, and there are 50,000 people who were disappeared. 5,000 of those people are children. Those three of those children who were disappeared when Marvin and the other kids were taken, they are among those 5,000 disappeared. You think, like, sometimes the numbers, I think, are really overwhelming. You think 50,000 people. Imagine a football stadium that holds 50,000 people, full of people enjoying life. And now imagine, they're gone. Where'd they go? Right? Mm-hmm. So there's a search for people. There's a search for excavations of mass graves in rural communities, but there's also a search for those 50,000 disappeared. And people like Marvin, who are among the few who actually survived torture, because it was one of the things about the Guatemalan military. People would say, there are no political prisoners because they killed them all. It's different from the detention centers in Argentina or in Chile, where they killed a lot of people as well. But in Guatemala, it's exponentially more people who were killed. And in the numbers of people who left, those numbers are huge. When 1.5 million people were displaced in a country that had about 8.9 million people at the time. That's a huge number of people. And then 50,000 people fled to refuge to Mexico. The number of Guatemalans in Los Angeles area, maybe Marvin has a better sense than I do of that, but it's very large. And not just in Los Angeles, but in the United States in general, the number of people who send remittances, who are sending money back to Guatemala, are maintaining the economy of Guatemala. There is no public project that helps provide services. If you look at rural communities in Guatemala today, those communities have computer. If they have computers in the schools, it's because there is an organization of people from that community who collect money and send that money home. And they set up public projects. And there are people who are working documented or undocumented in this country who are not earning huge amounts of money, but they send money home for their community and also for their family members. And these are people who were survivors who fled the violence, or who are the children of those people, or who are fleeing the violence of Guatemala today.
Mm-hmm. But, Marvin, clearly this was a state project. There's no, you know, this can't be attributed to any rogue group. And it was also, not only was it the Guatemalan military dictatorship pursuing this policy of genocide against their own civilians and their own people, the U.S. government at the time, under Ronald Reagan, supported them actively. We just mentioned that Rios Mott, the general, who, in fact, I don't know that he personally gave the order to torture you, but he's the person that one can hold responsible for the fact that at the age of 14 you were tortured, and that three of your schoolmates never saw the light of day again. So he got off the trial. He was convicted, and then it was overturned. What was the mechanism under which it's overturned, and how do you get justice if indeed the problem is with the justice system itself?
Okay. Yeah, Rios Montt was the chief of command at the moment. I want to explain something very briefly. In my case, I was detained by policemen and taken to a police department. In the police department, I was first interrogated by policemen, then I was interrogated by military officials. And how do I know they were military officials? Because they were wearing military uniforms. And they had a official, one was a colonel in the army. And he was feared by the other policemen and the other army people who were in that police department. Then, so now you see you have two institutions of the state, the police and the army participating in this case. Then we are taken from the police department, blindfolded, taken to a secret jailhouse on the outskirts of Guatemala City. There we were tortured for several days.
And this is a private home?
It's a private home, yeah, with very specific characteristics. I assume this was a house that was built for rich people. Why do I say this? Because the house had wooden floor, very luxurious lamps, and the bathrooms were very unique as well. So it wasn't a common house. It was different. People usually ask me, but if you were blindfolded, how do you know all these characteristics? First is that the blindfold will let you see a little bit through the nose, right? You can see slight things. And I was on the floor. All the time I was lying on the floor. So I was able to see the characteristics of the floor and the characteristics of the roof, of the ceiling of the house. So it was a very unique house. It wasn't a regular house. And that house was, I don't know for how long it was used to torture people. And we were held in this place for about 9 days. During this time, and this is when I think it's important to mention about Rios Montt, because on Sunday, June 6th of 1982, sometime during the day, the torturers, the perpetrators come and tell us there are going to be news about this case, about you guys. And we were blindfolded, naked, and then we listened a voice. I don't know if it was a radio or it was TV, but we hear sounds of someone talking on the radio. Immediately we recognize that the voice of Rios Montt, and he says that they have, that the army has 16 students held, and that soon they're going to be liberated and be given back to their parents. And this is Rios Montt on the Sunday speeches that he used to do. Every Sunday he used to give a speech on national radio and TV. So he is acknowledging publicly that the army or the state has the 16 students. 3 days later, we are giving back to the families through the amnesty program and accused of being subversives.
Except for three
students who are still disappeared. 34 years later, they still disappeared. We don't know what happened to them.
But you must have heard them being tortured, right?
Well, how do I know they were there? It's because one day we hear the voice, and some of the students who were with me in the same room recognizes the voice, and he calls up the guy by the nickname Gato, which means cat. In Guatemala, usually people who are kind of blonde or blue eyes or green eyes, we call them cat. I don't know. It's a popular thing. And so this person, Gato, so boss, like, are you? Is this you, Gato? And he says, yes, this is me. I'm with Chino. And just resist. All of us are going to get out. So those are the words that we exchanged with him. Mm-hmm. And we never heard of him again, anymore again, up to now.
But so how is the fix in terms of Rios Montt getting the verdict getting overturned? I understand that there's a massive demonstration that took place before the elections. The elections were rigged in the sense that there wasn't really somebody that could represent the opposition running. Mm-hmm. And the fact that this comedian won, and he's tied to the military, from my understanding, it just... The U.S. has recognized, the Obama administration has recognized what's happened in the past. How does the military hold on to its power? I understand in many ways the Guatemala is a kind of narco-democracy. Mm-hmm. So I'm curious to know whether it's because they've been involved in organized crime, that they have money. I mean, what keeps them immune from justice?
I think there are two important powers in Guatemala. One is the traditional rich people, the traditional rich
the
class.
The oligarchs, right?
Yeah. And the other is the military. The military who also became rich during the war. Okay.
How did they become rich?
They became rich by taking land from the peasants they were killing. They became rich through corruption by selling weapons, and then they became rich by getting involved into the drugs trafficking, and that's one of the ways they became rich. And also, since they had control of the state, they kept key positions within the state throughout the years, even after the peace agreements. I think Victoria can probably give us a better explanation of this phenomenon in Guatemala.
Look, Marvin's absolutely right. And the structures under the military regime have never been completely dismantled. In fact, very little has been dismantled in Guatemala. I remember when the accords were being negotiated, I interviewed a lieutenant colonel in the Guatemalan army, and he said, it doesn't matter what the accords say. Whoever has the most organization wins. We have the most organization. What did that lieutenant colonel go on to do? To be in charge of all the ports in Guatemala. Right? And so being in charge of ports, being in charge of transportation, there are lots of different structural places where the military had power.
Right, and those are the avenues for drug trafficking.
Drug trafficking, and all the little landing strips that the army set up all over the country to move soldiers during the war and to bomb villages and attack villages, all those landing strips became really useful for the movement of drugs in Guatemala. You can go.
And we have a war on drugs, in case you didn't know that. And yet, somehow, we can't force the hand of justice here. I'm afraid we've pretty much run out of time, but just a quick word from both of you. Marvin, what are you hoping to achieve from this 3-day conference at USC on the Guatemalan genocide?
Well, for me, the most important as a survivor is to educate the community about the incidents, the atrocities that the Guatemalan army committed in Guatemala, not only against the Mayan population, but to all the other population in Guatemala, whether they were civilians or not. The army decided to kill people in the cities and in the rural areas as well. And hundreds of thousands of people were victims of that war, of the politics of genocide.
I think we want to establish for once and for all that sí hubo genocidio. Yes, there was a genocide in Guatemala, and that a lot of work remains to be done, both in terms of truth-telling and justice.
And again, I've been speaking with cultural anthropologist Victoria Sanford, who studies human rights, international humanitarian law, the anthropology of genocide, race and gender in the Americas, and child soldiers within Guatemala and Colombia. She is the director of the Center for Human Rights and Peace Studies based at Lehman College, City University of New York, and has spent years uncovering evidence of genocide in Guatemala. And also joining us in the studio is Marvin Perez, who's a torture survivor from Guatemala, who was 14 when he was disappeared by the Guatemalan military and tortured, and of the 16 children taken with him, 3 were never seen again. And today, Marvin is a doctor trained in Western and Chinese medicine. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me and scroll down the right-hand side and sign up for iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.